Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Fire Science Show. If you're following the mainstream media, you probably see a lot of coverage of different wildfires happening around the world. Tragic fires that endanger local populations, tourists. And it's my feeling that this year is really nasty. There's a lot of them. And observing this trend of more and more media stories related to wildfires and wildfires becoming somehow recognized consequence of global warming, I wonder what's actually happening around. Is there an explanation of this increase in number and size of these fires and the reasons why we are exposed to them more and more? For this, I've invited renowned professor Albert Simioni from Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Albert's definitely one of the most known scientists dealing with wildfires, so I've asked him some difficult questions on what's happening around, why some fires are getting media attention, and if these fires are actually the worst ones we have, and maybe more importantly, to figure out if there's a space for fire engineers. Can fire engineers do anything about it? So hopefully a very interesting talk for you all, kind of sad that it's relevant to what's happening around the world. But yeah, it's a rapid commentary from one of the world's best experts on what's happening around. I hope you enjoy this. Let's spin the intro and jump into the episode. Welcome to the Fire Science Show. My name is Wojciech Wiengrzyński, and I will be your host. Fire Science Show is brought to you in collaboration with OFR Consultants, a multi-award-winning independent consultancy dedicating to addressing fire safety challenges. OFR is the UK's leading fire risk consultancy. Its globally established team has developed a reputation for preeminent fire engineering expertise, with colleagues working across the world to help protect people, property, and environment. In UK, that includes the redevelopment of Printworks building in Canada Water, one of the tallest residential buildings in Birmingham, as well as historic structures like the National Gallery, National History Museum, and National Portrait Gallery in London. Internationally, its work ranges from Antarctic to the Atacama Desert in Chile to a number of projects across Africa. In 2023, OFR is growing its team and is keen to hear from industry professionals who want to collaborate on fire safety futures. Get in touch at OFRconsultants.com. And now back to the episode on wildfires. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Fire Science Show. I'm today with Professor Albert Simioni from Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Hello, Albert.
Hello. Good to be here.
Good to have you in the show. We've talked about doing this episode a few months ago at SFP Berlin. I was in March, and the talk that we've discussed back then was about the global phases of wildfires. And then in the meantime, we had massive wildfires in Canada. We had massive wildfires in Greece. We just had massive wildfire in Hawaii. And then just yesterday, a massive fire in Tenerife. So many different parts of the world are burning. So many different ecosystems are burning. So indeed, the talk is perhaps more needed than ever before. So let's try to start with how different parts of the world create the very similar looking scenario, like how different ecosystems around the planet end up in a very, very similar scenario of a massive wildfire endangering humans and being huge loss. I'm used to like seeing one of those headlines like this year, this part of the world will burn, but this year it's crazy.
Yeah, and this year is pretty bad. I mean, we know that we have the El Nino phenomenon, and if you listen to climate scientists, you know, it's a very unusual one because we are compounding climate change with these cyclic phenomenon, and it's behaving differently. So what we're seeing now, I mean, it's due to different effects. First, we're past 8 billion on this planet. So we're present in any ecosystem. And then we have a climate change, and it's impacting all ecosystems. As our life on this planet is carbon-based, it's very flammable. It's just that you need to have the right conditions. And this year, they're happening in many places at different times in different ecosystems, like you say, but they're happening all over the world. This is pretty, pretty scary this year.
So all plant-based materials are flammable in some conditions. What conditions are expected to promote this size of wildfires? Because, I mean, wildfires were always there. Like, we always had fires. but very rarely you have so many such huge or so devastating fires at the same time. So is there any specific like set of conditions that promotes this type versus like, I don't know, smaller, normal, non-catastrophic wildfires? What's the trigger that pushes that fire?
Yeah. So there are different things, you know. First, we have to define normal, because as human beings, normal is our experience, you know, and maybe what our parents told us. And we like to say, oh, this has never been, or this was always this way. But we're actually living in an environment which is changing very, very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Very quickly for nature is in the span of a century or centuries. For human beings, it's a very long time. So I'm going to take an example. We are saying that, I think it was in 2016, the Gatlinburg fire in Tennessee, you know, we were saying, oh, it burned over there, but it never happens, you know. It happens. It's just that the return time for fires in Tennessee is slightly short than a century. So how do you accumulate knowledge about that? You know, you have what happened in a century. People left their crops, forest grew back, and people now are going in the forest for leisure to enjoy their time. And for their memory, nothing has ever happened. And then you have this big fire, people die, the town of Gatlinburg is erased, you know, which was a very small town before, now is a big touristic resort. And we're like, oh, this is a big catastrophe. I mean, fire is coming back. The problem is how frequently. Another example is California, where we're saying, oh, there are big fires every 5 to 10 years, you know. Now it's almost every year and several times a year. So we're in a changing environment. We know that we have more fires, but it's a compound of the return time of the fire and also urban sprawl and the fact that humans are impacting the ecosystems more and more.
If you say the return time is this many years, that's assumed on a statistical distribution of past fires or some models that allow you to estimate the probability of a fire of given size in given layout of fuel, weather patterns, human presence?
Oh, no, it's historical. And we know, you know, I'm a mechanical engineer, and in my mind, it's very simple. You take a system, you put it outside of its equilibrium positions, and you have big oscillations. And that's what we see with the weather pattern. That's what we see with the climate. We have catastrophic floods. We have catastrophic drought. And the return time is what was documented historically by fire ecologists who are looking at a longer time. Here, we're a little bit in the unknown. And those models are very difficult to establish. There is some research in Canada. There is some research in the US that I'm aware of, because it's not directly my field, where they're predicting more frequent fires and more intense fires.
And now for the fuels themselves, not been in that many parts of the world, but I can imagine that Greece looks a little different than Hawaii, and that looks a little different than forests in Tenerife. Is there the same pattern of accumulation of fuel, specific forest management characteristics that lead to the accumulation that eventually becomes a good setting for a large wildfire? Can we identify those and perhaps act on those? How do you view it?
So actually, it's very different context. For instance, and I'm not very much aware of what's happening in Tenerife beyond what we had in the news recently.
Yeah, that's very recent.
Yeah, pine forest and scrubland, which has burned. But if you look at Hawaii, it's on the side of the island, which is actually not getting much precipitation because of the mountains, you know. So on one side, on the eastern side of the island of Maui, you have the rainforest. On the other side, you have grassland. And this grassland is also due to the fact, again, it's not only the climate, it's also the people. It's all the sugarcane fields, and they're not now abandoned. And they're completely choked by invasive grasses, which are becoming very dry. But again, grass burns, and it's not something that people will make the news. You know, grass is burning all the time. What you need to have that in the news is you need that to impact people. And so the grass is igniting the first houses, and then the first houses burn. And there is a big wind because it's coming down from the mountains, and you have this effect. They talked about a hurricane south of Hawaii, which was kind of with a big depression north of Hawaii, creating this kind of a venturi effect. And so you have big winds, and it's hitting the first houses. The first houses burn, and then it's creating a lot of firebrands, and it's landing on other houses, and then you have a catastrophe. So in this case, grass becomes very, very dry in the dry season. And if you have drought, it's even worse, you know. But you need to ignite houses. For the fires in Canada, Canada is burning a lot. It's burning as much as the US and very often more than the US. But when it's not in California, it's in the boreal forest, it's not making much of the news, you know. It's just a small article. Now you have the smoke coming to all the south of Canada and all the eastern US and coming on top of Washington, D.C. And then it's all over the news. So It's a compound of climate change, of the fuel availability, which is different in different places, and the effect on people.
You've mentioned there being drought. I usually connected this wildfire season, at least to the extent I've perceived it, with summer season or hot days. I had the imagination that I hear about the fires, at least in the southern Europe, in the similar times where I hear about heat waves. But then the Canada fires that occurred this year, it was before the summer. It was before the climatologists were posting every day that, again, we have beaten the record temperature of July for the 17th day in a row. You know, it was before that. So it's not necessarily heat that is necessary. It's just the precipitation and then the moisture in vegetation that triggers those. Am I correct?
Yes. It's driven by the vegetation. Of course, the immediate conditions at the time of the fire, if it's raining that day, there will not be any fire, but It's triggered by the trends in the vegetation. And actually, if you're looking at Canada, you saw that the fire started in the east and burned in the east, and then they moved west. And now it's British Columbia, which is burning, and actually Washington State in the US. So when I moved to the US from France, where I'm used to exactly what you describe, you know, fires happen in the summer when it's past 30 degrees and very dry and the vegetation has dried. Actually, in the northeast of the American continent, the fire season is in spring. So what's happening there is as soon as the snow is off the ground, the vegetation hasn't grown back and is very dry from the winter. And you have usually dry conditions at this time. And that's when you have fires, and it can be, I don't know, 10 degrees outside, and still you have very intense fires because the vegetation is dry and the air is dry. And of course, if you have wind, you had the drought, little precipitations in the winter, it's happening. Then when the summer comes, it's humid and it's not very flammable anymore. So now the eastern shore of the American continent is pretty humid, you know? So the fires moved west, where it's more like following the Mediterranean pattern, that then you need the summertime to have things dry.
I know that in the past you also studied ecosystems that are pretty far, like Siberian wildfires, for example. So and in this case, the human presence is much less.
So here, when you're really in a remote area, like the north of Siberia, like I would say, not only the tundra, but the boreal forest, where I remember talking to a Russian firefighter who was telling me, oh, at the north of my oblast, you know, we have big fires. And I was like, oh, what are you doing to find them? He was like, we don't. I was like, why? He told me, because our helicopters don't have enough potential to reach them, not to come back, just to reach them. Okay. So when you're in huge places like that, and you have no humans, you can see more what's happening with climate change. And so one of the problems we have with climate change is that in the past, we used to say, you know, if the forest is burning up there, it's going to grow back and the emissions will be zero because it's coming back. But now with climate change, the ecosystems are weakened. You know, the droughts, the heat. The forests need the winter to recover, you know, and if there is no much of a winter or less of a winter, the ecosystem is unbalanced and vegetation is drying. It's more sensitive to pests and invasive species. And so you have these huge fires, for instance, in the Far East in Russia, and the forest is not coming back. And here, it's degrading the ecosystem, it's impacting all the species from vegetation to animals, and it's also creating a net emissions of carbon.
And observing all of those, if we base some of our future predictions on statistics like the fires here do not happen, and yet we see the conditions that are required for those wildfires to evolve to the size where they are very difficult to deal with and very dangerous to large amounts of people. Are we seeing, like, is any part of the planet actually safe at the moment? Do we see more and more parts of the globe entering hazardous areas? Are we going to have wildfire season everywhere?
I think we're at risk of that, yeah. Unless some places change into desert. You know, we were used to say that the return time in the Northeast, I'm talking about New England, so Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, you know, Connecticut, Rhode Island, these states, we used to say the return time is 70 years. And 70 years is a very long time. And that's not the future. That's the past. And the last big fire we had in New England was in Maine in 1946. And we're due. But on top of that, if you're looking at the area where the fire was, it was an area that has houses and some settlements. But now it's plenty of secondary houses with people who don't really know what to do with fire. If now the return time becomes 30 years or 25 years or even less, it becomes a very big problem. Actually, the Northeast of the U.S. is the biggest wine-underground interface and nobody thinks about fire. So we have a big, big vulnerability and we have more people. We have more urban sprawl and we're penetrating more the ecosystems.
And are we capable of predicting the immediate hazards? Like we have these fire weather alerts in Poland and I assume similar systems of similar magnitude would be everywhere. But to my understanding, they give you the probability of a fire to occur or how easy it is to set the fire, not the probability that a mega fire that will cost $50 billion will happen next door.
No. So that's the difficulty. And you see that it's difficult even for other things, right? You see that for floods, hurricanes, even earthquakes, you know, it's very difficult to prepare for something which is happening not very often. Telling people, hey, the next fire, maybe in 10 years or in 50 years, they will be okay. What can I do for that? And then you have catastrophes like in Hawaii. So it's very difficult to prepare for that. And one of the problems we have with fire is that, you know, we're thinking about a house fire, you know. We can put in place certain measures preparing for the catastrophe. You know, you have your smoke alarm, you evacuate, you know. We know that your house will burn. With wildfires, the problem is that the fuel is changing all the time. If you have no fires, you have an accumulation of fuel, and you have to deal with that. And if your wine-underground interface is very big, then you have a lot of fuel to take care of, you know? And so we decrease the ignitions and we were telling people, hey, look, there is a big risk of fire. Don't do anything. And it's just waiting for the next ignition to get out of control with the bad weather conditions. And it will happen. So even acting on the ignitions, telling people, hey, today is a catastrophic fire risk. Don't go in the forest. Don't do anything. It's just delaying the inevitable, you know?
While you were talking, I was wondering how long before you could actually issue a warning that it really looks like it's going to go to a catastrophic level before the fire ignites.
But in the US, you have red flag warnings, for instance, and they based on the meteorology. So it's the drought index, so the condition of the fuel plus the weather conditions. It's the time you can predict the weather. So if you're lucky, 2 weeks. If you're less lucky, just a few days. But again, I think it's very important. How do you quantify your risk that didn't happen? So if you're doing a good job, basically at preventing fire, it's playing against you in a way. And we still have to understand the other benefits that we're having. All the ecosystem services, all the things where we're benefiting from living next to the forest, having a cabin in the woods, or nature close to your house and everything, people don't give that very easily. And anyway, with the big population, we're pushing people to these areas. I think a lot is really to be prepared and to try to be less vulnerable to that. But again, if it's happening every 70 years, how do you even invest your money and your time for something which will happen once in 70 years? And you know how people are. If things go well, they will ignore you. And then if there is a big catastrophe, they will look for scapegoats and they will come after you.
So, how could you miss that? How in the earth you have not foreseen such a fire to happen? I guess every fire expert was asked with such a question when after a large fire happened in their country. Like how was it not obvious that it's going to happen, right? So Albert, in this ever-changing world, like how do you view the role of fire protection engineers? Like, okay, we're not forest managers. We're not dealing with wildfires directly. We are burdened with designing buildings. Some of our buildings will end up in this interface areas, of course. But what role do you see for FPEs in this ever-changing environment?
So when you talk about the wildland-urban interface, you have urban in it. So that's, again, about the buildings, you know. And I think that here we can really play a role. There is another aspect also that people have the tendency to discard. But we know wildfire, so we can also estimate an impact on a community, an impact on structures and things like that, like we do for instance, a spread from building to building and building separation, you know. So with SFPE, we have this big initiative about fires, and we really want to integrate that as our practice as fire protection engineers. So we can consider a lot of things, the impact of a fire in terms of heat and firebrands. We can consider structure hardening. We can consider community design to stop the spread of the fire in the communities. And I think that's down our alley. It's really a fire protection engineering thing. We even have tools that we use to make our cities safer, to prevent fires to spread in our cities that we could, of course, adapt and adjust and make evolve, but to deal with this problem. I really think that being safe, and especially the wildland-urban interface fires, we need to play a role. It's not only about forest and vegetation management, you know. It's very much about the built environment and how to make it safer and more resilient to fires.
Fire protection engineers' work is usually related to designing new buildings and erecting new structures. At least that's my experience with fire protection engineering. But having realization that environment is changing around you, that wildfires are literally closer to you now more than ever before, there's also a space of preparing the cities or buildings for what to come. So I guess there's also, you've used structural hardening as a term. I really guess that the research on how can we prepare our buildings, neighborhoods, communities, cities for the threat and prepare them to have, once the fires arrive, they're lesser of a damage. I guess that's an interesting direction where fire protection engineers of the future may play absolutely fundamental role at.
Yes. And we're in a context, you know, there is, and again, I'm going to talk about North America because this is what I know best, but there are new codes coming, new version of codes for the wildland-urban interface. So it's of course new buildings, but it's also renovations, retrofit and things like that. It's also protecting important assets like hospitals for touristic areas, hotels and places with a lot of people, schools and things like that. Not only from directly fire, but also from smoke. We mentioned that before. I think it's something where fire protection engineers have the skills and need to develop the ones we don't have for the moment to deal with this problem, you know. We're extracting smoke from buildings already when the smoke is inside. We can also do work on not letting the smoke get into buildings. It's based on the same fundamental skills, you know, and knowledge. We just have to integrate that better, but it's really down our alley. And I think we're actually the missing link to make our communities safer. You know, you have people doing fire management. You have people doing firefighting. But in terms of fire protection engineering, especially specifically for wildfires, we're still missing.
And even, you know, things like fire resistance, it both works both directions. The spread of fire on your facade or external walls or your roofs. I mean, of course, it, in our methods, we usually consider that from the inside to the roof and how it can spread further. But it's also like from firebrand that maybe perhaps landed on the roof, can it ignite or not? And also like very simple things like how to manage your own garden, how to build a defensible space for your own. I think here.
Where do you put your shed, your fences?
Yeah.
Where do you park your car? All of that has an importance, and it's coming back to community design. And community design in this case is what? What do we want to prevent? Fire spread. I mean, we know a bit about fire spread. We should be able to contribute to that.
So perhaps you can give me some examples of fires that happen in which a good fire protection engineering could make a difference.
Yeah. And so here we're going to talk about fire spread and fire impact, which is what we do as fire protection engineers. So okay. For instance, you take the Tubbs fire in 2017 in Northern California, north of San Francisco. It was Sonoma County. And so the Tubbs fire was a classical Diablo wind fire, which is pushed by the wind. And it's created this big tongue of fire, which came from the mountains and hit Santa Rosa and downtown Burr. And this fire happened in the mid-40s and was almost the same fire perimeter, you know, but with much less impact. What happened this time? This time you had a mixed forest of oak and grass. So the grass is burning very quickly, pushed by the wind, that's very, very quickly. And the oaks, and they will torch, you know, they will not create this big ground fire. Anyway, the vegetation was not continuous enough. There was some chaparral, which is creating firebrands. But the oaks are not creating much firebrands. But what's happening is now you have all these houses which are getting into the countryside. Then you have the houses which are close to the city and it's denser. So you're moving from what's called an intermix to the wooey, and you're increasing the density of houses. So the grass fire is coming, not very much firebrand, and it's hitting the first houses. The first houses burn because they're in the wild. They're in contact with the vegetation.
So there's continuity of the grasslands to the
first
garden, from garden to the house. Okay.
Yeah. They're in the countryside. So they burn. And now they burn, and with the construction materials and everything, they burn very intensely, and they do a lot of firebrands. These firebrands are pushed by the wind, and they're going to land further ahead, and they're going to ignite more houses where it's denser, but it's not the city yet. And now you have plenty of houses burning, and they're above the city in the mountains and pushed by the wind. And now you have a storm of firebrands landing in the city, and the city is burning. Actually, the fire crossed the city, burned the whole city, and became a wildfire again past the city. So that's the kind of things where first we created this problem. And secondly, I think that's where fire protection engineers can play a role. They can say, hey, look, your house is not only a danger to itself because it's in the forest and it needs to be protected, but they can tell communities, look, you have all these row of houses. If they burn, they're going to ignite more houses downwind. So we have to protect them more. We have to do more. We have to clean more fuel. We have to make them more resistant, to harden them more. But those houses would be the trigger of the domino effect of the catastrophe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an example where I think as FPEs, we can estimate the exposure of the houses and we can design them or help design them so they will not burn and become a source of firebrands. So that's an example.
So this is like stopping the chain reaction, like developing solutions, protection measures that would prevent from this chain of events spiraling out of control. And you can also, like, there's only one direction. If there is a very, like, sharp boundary, there's a forest, then you have some cabins in the woods, then you have the city outskirts, denser populated area than the city itself. You can quite well identify the layers where a certain measures should be introduced as perhaps a community policy, not just the burden of the owner of that city, because it's in the community best interest that these first houses are protected.
Something which was completely overlooked is that the houses inside of the city, they were like, oh, you're not at the wildland urban interface. You don't really need to do much. But actually the firebrands landed there, and it was a system where we have to break this domino effect. And we have to identify the risk and the potential for fire to spread this way. And that's what fire protection engineers can do.
What you said is not just fuel management. It's not just drought. It's not just vegetation, but civil engineering, community design, fire protection engineering has a big space to go. And we may not be the most helpful assets for forest managers, but we're a critical asset for managing communities and buildings. So that's very good.
Yeah. And even in forests, you have national parks where you have people, you need sheltered areas, you know, you need to protect assets, you know. For instance, at WPI, we're sending people to protect buildings in Yellowstone, you know, it's our students do projects for that. So, and that's again a fire protection engineer thing, you know. Actually, the National Park Service is hiring our students, our graduates. So I think we can participate in so many aspects, you know. But of course, we're more involved when there is a structure, an infrastructure, an access, people to manage. That's really, really what we do. Not looking at only the fires like up in the mountains, you know. But there are plenty of places where we can play a role and we can help. I think we're the missing link, actually, in wildfire management nowadays. You know, you manage the vegetation, you have your codes and standards, and you're not making the link between the impact to the fire spreading communities to the loss.
Another thing that I had on my agenda is how much damage different fires do, because there definitely is a difference. Imagine if Central Park in New York burns, like that would not be a huge area burnt, right? But yeah. What a devastating fire that would be. And then you compare it to areas in boreal forests in Russia when guys cannot fly that far with a helicopter to even see the fire. And then there perhaps could be a square kilometer burning at the same time. And no one bats an eye. So tell me, what makes fires get to the headlines, and which fires are the worst from this medial perspective and perhaps from other objective measures that we can apply to them?
So you have different factors play. The obvious one is climate change. So it's making a difference. You know, maybe you have more fires in Poland than you had before. I know about Sweden, Norway being concerned about fires, you know. There is another thing, and here I'm going to be a bit cynical. Look at, for instance, the fires in Brazil under the past president, who actually had a catastrophic policy about managing the Amazon, you know. The pressure of agriculture and conservation and fire prevention, actually. And there were huge fires, and it took a very long time for associations to raise the alarm. It came to the United Nations. But at the end of the day, the concern on the day-to-day for most of the people was very, very little. You know, it's like these big fires in Russia. They're devastating the boreal forest. They're net emitters of carbon. But people don't really fathom that. Now, if it's impacting people, it'd be the smoke coming to Washington, D.C. And there was a joke saying that you need smoke in Congress for actually the politicians to really, really care. But that's the reality of it. You need smoke in Brussels too and in other capital. But that's the reality of it, you know. It's really making the news when it impacts people. For instance, the damage on the ecosystem is big in California, but it's less than in Brazil. But it's impacting more people and also, unfortunately, again, richer areas, you know, and then it's making the news. So the impact on people, the impact on their life, on their activity is very important, you know. So why is burning, you know, and it's making the news and everything? Imagine if it's happening in Indonesia or in Guatemala. How long will it make the news? It will make the news, but maybe a couple of days. So I'm sorry to be a bit cynical here, but it's when it's impacting people that it's very important. And also it depends where it impacts, you know. If you have a big fire, which is completely destroying the Verde Hills, I can tell you that it will make the news for a very long time.
At least three movies about a heroic firefight.
Exactly. Three movies with no smoke, just flames.
But you're correct. I think the first time I've heard about the Canadian fires was when the pictures start showing from New York with orange sky.
Exactly.
That's when you heard about it. In a similar way, a few years ago when we had the devastating California fires, people started talking about it when you had pictures of Golden Gate Bridge in orange everywhere. So, yeah. so you know, this signs of wildfire that it's near, that it's actually damaging. People started caring about the quality of the air surrounding of them. It triggered an impressive response of the public in general. But those fires are not necessarily the biggest by economic loss, right?
It depends. I mean, so you can imagine for Maui, for instance, the economic loss will be tourism. And actually, it's like the tsunami, because in the end, it's a natural disaster, defined natural, mm-hmm. right? Even a flood is a disaster because there are people and economic activities in there. If you're flooding your floodplain and there is nobody, who will care? Maybe we'll look at the ecosystem and everything. But again, sorry for being cynical, but it's going to make the news for one day, you know? So it's impacting people. And you have the people who are saying, hey, there are still tourists coming to the island and they shouldn't come. And even like local people, even the movie star Jason Momoa, say, don't come to Maui. And now they're like, yeah, but please come, because we need the economic activity, because for us, it's a double whammy, not having the economic activity. So that's a very important aspect. And it's very difficult to quantify. I mean, I know that there is some research in Europe, but there is some research in the US at NIST, for instance, looking at the impact on the economic activity, because it's also a driver for policy. The politicians, they will look, of course, they're looking at the loss of life, the loss of property. But if there is an economic impact long term, it's also a motivator to plan better.
The second thing, you mentioned that when we had a chat before, the impact on economy of regions, like closing down airports, long-term economical sustained damage, because some facilities have to be closed, evacuated.
And for the little story, I remember we're having a lot of our activities in the northeast of the US, because WPI is close to Boston. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing a lot of burns with the Forest Service in New Jersey. And I remember a few years ago, a colleague sends me a photo of actually Manhattan under a blanket of smoke, you know? And my question to him is like, did they close Newark, which is the airport between New Jersey and New York City? Mm-hmm. And he was like, no. And I was like, okay, so we're still going to struggle for funding, you know? that's the reality, you know? So when you see this big impact on the economy, and I remember the fires around Moscow, which closed the airports. So it's the fires in Indonesia, which closed airports in neighboring countries in 1997? Mm-hmm. So it's happening. And that's where you have an incentive to do more. Of course, when it's happening to another country, it's very difficult to do. But you have other effects which are more difficult to quantify. That's for the fires in Canada this year. That was for the fires in Northern California, you know, in 2017. We're talking about these fires and the big number is $13 billion, sorry. And that's very big. But because of the geography and the fact that the wine county over there, Sonoma and Napa, the smoke stayed for a very long time. And so we know that not only the short-term people with asthma, but even longer-term people are starting to study the increase in cancer rate in these places. So you have the short-term impact, like tourism and people canceling, and you have the long-term impact. And it's very difficult to quantify. And if you can add more things, for instance, in California, you have insurance companies leaving the state. Mm-hmm. Imagine the impact on that. Now people are leaving California and they're citing not only the wildfires, but now you just have big floods in Southern California. But they're citing the environment and the problems as one of the reasons for them to leave California. So that's an enormous economic impact. You know,
you mean that people cannot insure their houses anymore? Or?
In some places, you cannot find insurance to the point that the state of California had to have an insurance system which is made by the state, because the private companies are not insuring anymore. And in some places, you can insure your house. But if you have, a small house, which is $150,000, and your insurance premium is like $20,000, how will you insure that? And of course, it impacts also inequalities, right? If you have your big mansion again in Beverly Hills, you know, it's several millions, but your welfare insurance is $100,000. You're going to pay it, you know. But if it's $20,000 and you have a small salary and a small house, you're not going to pay. So this impact is changing the way people live and are resilient to this catastrophe. People lose everything.
I think you have perhaps now answered my previous question. How can we foresee a massive fire coming if insurance companies put premium of 20% of your net value of a house as an insurance, or they leave completely? That's perhaps a sign a big fire is coming. And now I have a urge to interview some risk profilers from such companies to understand how would they establish the enormous risks. We've touched a little bit about the forest management and accumulation of vegetation, the drying process, the conditions in which it happens. Are there like any general good practices that you see lacking throughout the world that jump every now and then in those places, or it's pretty much individual situation in each country?
I mean, the local situation has an impact, you know, but you see trends that you see in different countries. So let me cite a few trends. So let's take Europe and Southern Europe in particular, but Europe in general. The abandonment of rural areas. You have vegetation growing where you had not natural, but man-made fire breaks, you know, with crops. Also people in the countryside. I mean, in my place, my grandparents were talking about the bells of the village, you know, ringing when there was a fire and everybody going to try to help. Now I don't know if the bell will ring, or maybe just automatic and it will not ring from the fire, you know, ringing from the hour because there are nobody left in the villages. So you see that. That's also a bit similar in a different context with Hawaii when you had sugarcane fields and they were abandoned. Not saying that sugarcane may have been the best thing to grow in Hawaii, but that's a fact.
So you'd have previously well-managed farmlands where people would be living off them. They would rotate crops, they would grow things, manage them, plow, clean up, maintain. The vegetation can grow only this high because then you just take crop and sell it. So there is no overgrowing for years. And suddenly these people, for some reason, are gone, or this process is no longer sustained by them.
Vegetation is growing.
Vegetation is growing without control, and there's like no people in there. And they've created an ecosystem which is very easy to invade by a certain invasive species, for example.
Exactly.
Right?
With climate change, where they may get a competitive edge. So you have continuous fuel, which becomes very flammable. Because if it burns, the vegetation which will come back is the vegetation which is adapted to fire. So you get ecosystems where actually the species which are thriving are the species which are doing very well when there is fire. And so that's one of the example. Another example is fire exclusion. And that's, again, a compounding effect. But I remember when I was a firefighter in France, the policy was to extinguish every fire. Mm-hmm. And then you have, again, fuel growing. In the US, we had until, let's say, the mid-90s or the end of the 90s, the 10 a.m. fire policy, which happened after the big burn in the beginning of the 20th century in the Rockies, where basically the policy from the Forest Service, and I'm talking in the wildlands here, not close to the cities and everything, like in the mountains, in the big pine forest that we all think about when we think about Montana or Colorado and everything. So every fire which started one day had to be extinguished by 10 a.m. the day after. And if you miss that deadline, you aimed at the 10 a.m. the other day, the next day. So we excluded fire from the ecosystems. But fire was there for a very long time. If you look at the news in the last few days, you know, some paleontologists say that actually the saber-tooth tiger in North America and some of the big mammals disappeared because people burned actually the land. And that's how they disappear. Also something which is becoming a research topic in the US and in Canada and in other places. Looking at the practice from the native populations and the historical practices where they were keeping the ecosystem open with the low fuel, especially in the forest, in the undergrowth, to avoid the surface fuel to burn and then flames to reach the canopies of the trees and to maybe have less tree densities and so on. It's something which becomes more and more a concern of today. One of the problems is the cost of doing that, because you're talking about very huge areas. So fire and prescribed burns are a cheap way to do it, you know, but there are other ways. You can masticate fuel, you can prune trees, you can do a lot of things. But one of the things which is sure is that fires were always in the ecosystem. Now our ecosystem is unbalanced and it's generating more fires. It's accompanied with climate change. There are more people in contact with the ecosystem, and we remove the natural fires, and we don't want them in many places. I mean, we don't want fires in Canada or even in New Jersey blanketing New York with a smoke every season. So we have to reintroduce fire or something similar, but artificially, by people, by burning, by removing fuel and doing all of that. It's expensive. We just have to do it and accept that.
I know about trying to reach to indigenous practices also in management of forests and fuels. In Europe, we have PyroLife project, which is also going into that and also sharing the experiences from the south to north. Actually, I'm very due with update on PyroLife because I've interviewed Catalina when she was starting the project then. I know the PhDs are finishing now, so perhaps a good moment for a catch up. One more question regarding the agriculture practice. We also see significant industrialization of agriculture. At least it's something that I observed with my own eyes in Poland for the last 20 years. The farms looked very different 20 years ago when we were entering the European Union, and it looks like factories nowadays, you know, big machines, they can handle much bigger areas. It's not anymore someone who would invite their whole family to pick up potatoes. There's a machine that does that anymore, to rejoice of the children of Poland of modern times, because that would be inevitably a part of your summer some decades ago. But now less people handling more ground, doing it in a more mechanized way. Is this also having some sort of an impact on how threats from wildfires are appearing and changing?
Yes, and agricultural fires are an issue. For instance, in Victoria, in Australia, I visited over there, and they cut the wheat and they leave the bottom of the stems, and it can burn very quickly and very intensely, you know. And also, I have the same experience. You know, I visited my family in the northwest of France, you know, and my aunt was complaining about the fact that there are no hedges anymore. She cannot hear the birds because basically the machines are crossing the road and just like harvesting continuously. And they removed all the obstacles. So it's all this big one crop open land everywhere. And we know that when ecosystems are basically weakened like that, you have less diversity, which is a horrible, even excluding fire, but you also make the bed for a very unbalanced thing. You have a weakened ecosystem, which is very continuous, which can burn in an easier way, which is also making the bed for invasive species and all of that. And if you stop growing crops over there, because I don't know, we're in a globalized world, right? And the price of wheat is collapsing because of other reasons, then it becomes a catastrophe. You have all these open land, which is going to grow wide or completely unbalanced, and it's going to be a huge fire risk.
I really foresee that if you have, it's not longer a single farmer, you know, working to make a good being for his family, but rather a large specialized food manufacturing company. And in a given year, they foresee that, for example, wheat price is not justifying the cost of running operations. They could perhaps just leave the field to stay for a year because it's going to be cheaper. Like if there becomes an economical reason for not doing anything, they will. And they will not worry about, you know, the local birds or other elements, fire included.
Yeah. And then you generalize that and you talk about the Amazon or you talk about Indonesia. And then that's happening at a very huge scale. These whole fields of plantations, you know. And what happens if it's not productive anymore? And already they're not only changing, and then we are getting into very complex problems, but they're not only changing the fuel. They're even changing the climate. For instance, the Amazon is becoming the place where you have plantations. It's becoming drier. because you don't have the humid forest anymore. You don't retain the water. No?
And for the final part, I've started, or at some point of the interview, I've mentioned Central Park on fire. But I really wonder, is it a possibility that fires are not only endangering the wildland urban interfaces, but the beautiful green cities that we have with multiple parks, you know, buildings with beautiful green facades? Like, I have a feeling that it's a space we have not explored yet, but boy, we will at some point.
Yeah, I agree.
What's your view?
And there are already some research. I remember Edinburgh doing research on facades of buildings with the vegetation and the flammability of that. Other people have done such research. And then we're coming to another fire problem. Oh, by the way, I'm forgetting about that. But in Australia, we sent a group of students from WPI. You know, we have these international centers. And we go and they do like undergrad projects. And in Australia, there is a definition because it's a very flammable ecosystem about urban parkland interface. So the parks inside of cities, but they're much more flammable than Central Park, you know? Okay. And again, like you see for weed fires, if your park burns and it's igniting enough houses with weed, the houses will be the fuel and they will create the fire burns and spread the fire even without vegetation. You see a lot of the fires in, I'm going to take the example of California again, because there are a lot of photos of that in 2017, 2018, where houses are burned and the vegetation isn't touched.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that, and you have the vulnerability of these systems, and the fact that it's also, when you're talking about these green cities, when you're talking about these parks, it's coming back, what I meant to say before, to the problem we had in Europe after the 2008 crisis, you know, where a lot was based on passive fire protection in buildings. And then the maintenance decreased and you had buildings with some, I don't know, spraying on the frame, on the beams and everything. And it was not sprayed well because the companies had lots of skills. It was not maintained. And then the danger was increasing. Mm-hmm. What happens in very rich places where we are developing all of that, and then there is an economic crisis and we cannot maintain. We're not watering our parks, our facades anymore. There is climate change and all of that. And then we're creating a problem for the future. So that's yeah, good. I mean, sustainable. We all want sustainable cities. We have to do something. I mean, we're 8 million on this planet. We're like crickets, right? And crickets, actually, in the US, it was like that, the locust plague in the end of the 90th and the beginning of the 20th century. It's creating very unbalanced ecosystems, you know. So we want to be more sustainable, but also we have to be careful about what we wish for. We have to think about the future. And we know that human beings, we're not very good at that.
We're also doing research on green facade, and I clearly see the evolving risks with these systems drying, but also see the general trends to put more of those in the city. So that's a subject for a future discussion. But are the urban megafires a thing of the past, or just temporarily on hold? That's a big question for me.
You know how it's happening, and we see that for many things, you know. We think we have solved the problem and we just don't even consider it anymore. We have smoke alarms in houses, you know, now we put sprinklers in some, you know, and we think it's solved, and then it's coming back, and then we react. So we're unfortunately a catastrophe driven field, you know, like some other fields, you know. Talk about Europe and the UK, France, and other places. I'm sure you'll have a similar example for Poland about building in floodplains. Oh, we have levees and dams, and we're good. And now we have these enormous rains, and we're not good anymore. And talk about Japan, and when there was the big tsunami, you know, people running for their life and passing old stones when it was built in old Japanese. Don't build beyond this point. So we're doing that. And with one fires, we're already seeing that happen, you know. In the US, we thought that we had excluded fire from our cities. Like we had the great Chicago fire, the great Baltimore fire, all the latest at the beginning of the 20th century. And we designed our cities to resist to fire from the inside. And no fire is coming from the outside, and cities are burning again. In 2017, downtown Santa Rosa, north of San Francisco, burning was a big surprise to a lot of people.
Well, that's an unfortunate conclusion for the podcast. There are many things that we are perhaps not considering today, and perhaps we should consider for the future, because it's not looking like the trend will revert and we will be seeing less and less of those fires.
And I don't want to finish on a negative note.
Okay.
I'm an engineer. I think that we can design our way out of this problem. You know, we just have to work on that. We have to do more research. We have to develop the engineering tools to do that, you know, but I think humans are also very inventive, but we need some pressure to start to look at the problems, you know. And we know that, for instance, NSF issued a call for rapid research on the Hawaii fires. So we're reacting to the catastrophes, but then people find solutions. It's just a difficult time because the problem is multifaceted, you know, and very complex. But we just have to put our human ingenuity and human thinking, problem solving, and throw our solutions at it, and we'll get out of that. I don't want to be all negative. I think even the concern of people for the ecosystem and everything, before it was burning back in the woods, who care, you know? So we are more mindful of the problems. We want to find solutions for the good of the future generations. We just need to step up our game, you know, and do more, but we can design our way out of these problems.
Albert, thank you very much for your insights on the events happening around the world and a broader context of the wildfires, and hope to see you again in the show. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And that's it. Wow, what an episode. A very difficult discussion with Albert, and to some extent very sad one, but with an optimistic end that engineers have a role to play and there are things that we can do to improve the solution worldwide. In general, I really loved how Albert brought the engineers into the equation and shown pathways for fire safety engineers on how we can be the missing link in wildfire prevention and helping our communities fight against wildfires. It was also quite interesting when he mentioned that you need smoke in Washington to make legislation happen. Accidentally, as Albert mentioned, the fires were moving to the west, and as I am doing this edit, the wildfires are in Washington. It's just the wrong Washington. Come on, wildfires, you need to attack the DC. So we have solutions for our problems noticed by the politicians. Anyway, I hope you as a fire engineer feel empowered after this episode. There are things that we can do as fire engineers in helping our communities, in driving our research, in providing our expertise to provide fire-safe communities. There are a lot of man-made issues that lead to wildfires that we thoroughly discussed agriculture and how changes in this field lead to increase in fire risk and fire hazards. So perhaps that's a place where we can act. And in general, it feels like, the fires are there. They're not going anywhere. We're going to hear more about them. Hopefully, they won't be that devastating. There are things we should do to make sure they're not as devastating. And let's hope for a better future, and let's be part of that better future altogether. Thank you for listening to the Fire Science Show, and hope to see you here next Wednesday. Cheers. Bye. This was the Fire Science Show. Thank you for listening, and see you soon.